the first person who is our guest speaker tonight is Professor Charles Hirschkin in the Department of Anthropology. He will be speaking about American foreign policy and its relationship to the war in the region. Thank you.
Thanks very much. I'm going to start by talking about the war on terror. We have lived with the war on terror for half a decade now. What appeared initially to be a rather vague call to arms, posed against a shadowy enemy, has now piled up enough rubble, enough suffering and death, and more than enough lies to stand clearly before us as a shining monument to Bush's America. I want to reassess this war for a moment, its stated and unstated aims, and what has been done in its name to the peoples of the Middle East. The war has been framed in apocalyptic terms from its outset, a war between freedom and tyranny, between barbarism and civilization. Its alleged target, as President Bush reiterated in a speech delivered a few days ago, are the, quote, Al-Qaeda terrorists and those who share their ideology. These terrorists, Bush suggested, are driven, quote, driven by a radical and perverted vision of Islam that rejects tolerance, crushes all dissent, and justifies the murder of innocent men, women, and children in the pursuit of political power. They hope to establish, Bush continues, a violent political utopia across the Middle East, which they call a caliphate, where all would be ruled according to their hateful ideology. This caliphate would be a totalitarian Islamic empire encompassing all current and former Muslim lands, stretching from Europe to North Africa, the Middle East, and Southeast Asia. End of quote. In short, this is a war for the soul of the world, and of course its resources. Let's look more closely at this terrorist enemy. First and foremost is Al-Qaeda, whatever exactly this still elusive group is, and that is still far from certain. This group, or those claiming to act in its name, has carried out a series of brutal military actions, most dramatically the attacks of September 11, 2001. Yet, as many observers of this war have commented, despite the seriousness of the threat this group represents, relatively few resources have been dedicated to countering its activities and bringing its leaders to justice. So if Al-Qaeda is only a small part of this war, then who is it directed at more broadly? Chief among those said to share Al-Qaeda's hateful ideology are Islamic activists throughout the Middle East. This would include, for example, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, a group that has not only refrained from violent action since the 1950s, but that has in recent years become the primary agent within the Egyptian political arena, working toward the expansion of democratic political rights. Indeed, when I spoke with democracy activists in Cairo this summer, even those who strongly opposed the centrality given to Islamic religious traditions within the Brotherhood's political vision, they nonetheless viewed the party's efforts to bring about the democratization of Egyptian political life as both sincere and worthy of support. There is a wide consensus among observers of Egypt that if a truly free and fair election were to be held there today, the Muslim Brothers would easily win. So one piece of the war on terror in regard to Egypt has been a renewed support for the dictatorship of Hosni Mubarak, including a toning down of all objections to the regime's increasingly brutal suppression of democracy activists from both secular and religious parties. The dictatorial monarchy of Saudi Arabia also has benefited from America's willingness to countenance its brutal repression of Islamic political activists, those who have dared to criticize the corrupt and predatory behavior of the ruling elite and their refusal to enact democratic reforms. These two regimes, Egypt and Saudi Arabia, widely recognized as corrupt, authoritarian, undemocratic, remaining in power only through extensive practices of state violence carried out with American financial and military support, these two regimes are routinely applauded as moderate in the US media because of their willingness to parrot American positions on command, as occurred during the recent war in Lebanon. Hezbollah is another group at the top of the US, the America's hit list of Islamic enemies of civilization. Zeyna Zaatari will speak more about this group in a little while, so I'll just make a couple of observations that problematize the association of this group, both with Al-Qaeda or with the murderous totalitarian caliphate movement that Bush describes. Hezbollah emerged among the Shia population of southern Lebanon in 1982 as a movement dedicated to freeing that country from its occupation by a foreign power, namely Israel. Since Israel ended its 18-year occupation of southern Lebanon in 2000, the number of active Hezbollah fighters has declined significantly, and the greater part of the movement's activities are now focused on social and political issues, providing welfare services to the poor in Shiite neighborhoods, building schools, and taking part in electoral politics. Anxieties about its armed militias aside, Hezbollah had increasingly shown itself to be a positive social force in the country. And while these that I met when I visited the country, right before and during the Israeli bombing campaign, had no wish to see their nation again entangled in a conflict with Israel, they viewed Hezbollah's militant posture as an unfortunate but natural outgrowth of Israeli belligerency. After all, as I mentioned, Hezbollah had not existed until 1982, the 1982 Israeli invasion. Importantly, the movement has no ambition to create an Islamic State in Lebanon or anywhere else. Rather, the movement's leadership has long emphasized its commitment to respecting the religiously plural character of Lebanon and has been flexible, pragmatic, and frequently liberal in its political engagements with the Lebanese state. These few observations are not meant to exonerate Hezbollah in any way, a group that, among other things, has killed numerous Israeli citizens with its inaccurate but sometimes deadly missile attacks, 43 civilians killed during the recent war. The point is that the label of terrorist or Islamo-fascist, as pre-election strategists have recommended we use now, is radically inadequate for describing resistance movements of these kinds and the complex context in which they emerge. Let me just mention suicide bombing here, as the terrifying figure of the suicide bomber has come to play a key role in scaring the American public into supporting the brutal policies of the current administration. Robert Pape, a professor of political science at the University of Chicago, did a study on what he called suicide terrorism, as it has been used by diverse groups around the world, including Hezbollah, which carried out a series of suicide attacks, 41 to be exact, between 1982 and 1986. He was able to uncover biographical materials, Pape was, for 38 of the attackers. He found, and I quote, that only 8 were what he calls Islamic fundamentalists. 27 were from leftist political groups, like the Lebanese Communist Party and the Arab Socialist Union. 3 were Christians, including a female high school teacher with a college degree. All were born in Lebanon. What these suicide attackers and their heirs today shared, he argues, was not a religious or political ideology, but simply a commitment to resisting foreign occupation. Indeed, Pape found this to be the case in all historical instances when recourse had been made to suicide missions, including the IRA, ETA in Spain, the ANC in South Africa, and the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka. In each case, suicide bombing, he found, always related to conditions of territorial dispossession and colonial occupation. Pape is a security expert and in no way a sympathizer with radical ideologies. Indeed, he's taught air power strategy at a U.S. Air Force college, among other things. But his conclusions completely subvert the image of the suicide bomber that is promoted to sell the war on terror. Suicide bombing is a strategy of the weak against vastly more powerful adversaries and has nothing to do, he concludes, with religious zealotry or with what's been called a culture of death or any other such notions. And here I should mention Hamas as well. Over the years, Hamas has repeatedly planned and carried out the brutal murder of Israeli citizens in a long series of attacks that have frequently involved the death of the attacker, him or herself. This movement, on the other hand, has nothing to do with Al-Qaeda, with evil empires, or fascist totalitarian caliphates. Like Hezbollah, Hamas emerged in the context of occupation, and its policies, militancy, and overall goals cannot be understood outside that context. To say this, of course, is not to endorse those policies and actions of this group, which indeed, in many instances, have been morally reprehensible, I would argue. But we must recognize that the violence deployed by this group does not occur in a vacuum, but under conditions of Israeli military occupation, of the continual unrelenting dispossession of the Palestinian homes, fields, and territories, of the daily destruction of every social resource that might make possible a sane, secure, and hopeful existence for Palestinian children. This is life in the open-air prison that much of Palestine has become under Israeli occupation, a life of rubble, daily harassment and humiliation, of hopelessness and despair. So even if we leave completely aside the question of culpability, of moral assessment, of our own personal commitment to one faction or the other, as we should in this moment of discussion. Leaving aside all such judgments, we must recognize that these are the conditions under which Hamas has emerged, under which its forms of violent struggle have been nurtured. Hamas is not born of what Bush calls Islamo-fascist ambitions, but of a half century of brutalization as resistance to the violent erasure of a people. All of this is rather obvious, even to the ex-prime minister of Israel, Ehud Barak, who in an off-guarded moment acknowledged, quote, "Palestinian, it's possible I would join a terrorist organization." I don't want to say any more about Hamas, as I know Bashara Dumani will be speaking at greater length about this. Let me just summarize what my argument so far by saying, whatever one thinks about the programs and activities, the Islamic organizations targeted in the war on terror bear almost no resemblance to the demonic figures conjured up by the Bush administration and its media puppets to justify U.S. and Israeli policies. Well, actually, they do share two things. One, they're Muslims. And two, they mobilize resistance to the political, territorial, and military ambitions of the United States and Israel in the Middle East. Beyond propping up dictatorial regimes, silencing calls for opening up the political field in Middle Eastern countries, and destroying movements that resist the occupation of their lands by foreign armies, the war on terror has also accomplished more ambitious tasks, such as the complete destruction of Iraq and the slaughter of what a study by the Lancet Medical Journal puts at 150,000 of its citizens. And now Lebanon has been reduced to rubble as well. A country recently, Safa Mahmoud just noted, had been held up by the United States as a testimony to the progress of democracy in the region, now a wasteland of starvation and disease. And while the U.S. did not execute this sentence upon the Lebanese, it ensured that Israel would have the time and weaponry to carry it out. And now we are gearing up for Iran. Before I turn to Iran, let me ask, so if the goal of the war on terror has not centered on capturing the perpetrators of 9/11 so as to prevent further such attacks, then what are the goals of this war? To answer this, we only need turn to a few of the policy studies written in the 1990s by men who later became the primary architects of the Bush administration's foreign policy. Many of these men, including Richard Perle, the chairman of the Defense Policy Board Advisory Committee during Bush's first term, Douglas Feith, the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy until 2005, and Paul Wolfowitz, the Deputy Secretary of Defense again until 2005, all had close ties to Israel's right-wing Likud party, a fact that explains why in the foreign policy stance they crafted, what's commonly known as the Bush Doctrine, Israeli interests and American interests are generally viewed as one and the same. The core of this doctrine, as is well known, is that the U.S., in its status as the world's sole superpower, should diminish its reliance on negotiations, contracts, international legal structures, and diplomatically achieved agreements in the pursuit of its aims in favor of a tactic of military preemption and unilateral action. Overall, the U.S. should extend its ability to project political and military power throughout the Middle East, a task that would require the construction of U.S. military bases across the region. Thus, a report from 2000 put out by the Project for a New American Century, a conservative think tank whose members included Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, and John Bolton, states, while the unresolved conflict in Iraq provides the immediate justification, and this is written in 2000, of course, well before the second war in Iraq, provides the immediate justification for U.S. military presence, the need for a substantial American force presence in the Gulf transcends the issue of the regime of Saddam Hussein. It then goes on, over the long term, Iran may well prove as large a threat to U.S. interest in the Gulf as Iraq has. And even should U.S.-Iranian relations improve, retaining forward-based forces in the region would still be an essential element in U.S. security strategy, given the long-standing American interests in the region. Now, how are Iran and Iraq going to be convinced of the desirability of U.S. military bases on their territory? Through aerial bombing, of course. War, in other words, would allow, first, for the establishment of a permanent military presence throughout the region. Second, it would ensure access to cheap oil. And third, it would allow the U.S. to put into place political and economic structures favorable to U.S. corporate profits in the region, a strategy of occupation, pillage, and the permanent subordination of the Middle East to direct U.S. military control. not exactly a war on terror. Afghanistan provided the first possibility for putting such a vision into place. Although the country remains war-torn and impoverished, the U.S. bombing campaign has made possible the establishment of numerous military bases in Afghanistan and neighboring Central Asian republics. The bombing and military occupation of Iraq came next, an event well planned well before 9/11, as White House documents now reveal. And although the aftermath of the war has not unfolded exactly on script, the project of extending permanent U.S. military force and ensuring the conditions amenable to corporate pillage have continued unabated since the war's onset. In 2004, the Coalition Provisional Authority, headed by Paul Bremer, issued a series of edicts, illegal by any measure, that privatized vast areas of the Iraqi economy, including oil and banking, which can now be placed entirely into the hands of foreign corporations. Executives from ExxonMobil, Shell, and Halliburton have already negotiated deals on how to carve up Iraqi oil. Moreover, thanks to another Bremer edict, these corporations can transfer all profits out of the country tax-free, with no obligation to invest in the local economy, hire Iraqi workers, or provide public services of any kind. Last paragraph. Sorry. Now, the destruction of Lebanon has been added to the pile. And although it was carried out by Israel's military, it was Israel's military that crushed the lives and hopes of many Lebanese people. It was carried out with American backing, prior consultation with American arms, quickly resupplied when needed, and with diplomatic cover. Why would the U.S. facilitate and encourage the killing of so many civilians, the complete destruction of the infrastructure, the dissemination of 100,000 bomblets across a vast swath of southern Lebanon? To reduce terror in the world? Not really a credible claim. According to Seymour Hersh, in a recent article in The New Yorker, according to his contacts with the Defense Department, the destruction of Lebanon, planned out in close consultation with the Bush administration as long as a year ago, was seen by the Americans as a prelude and test case for a potential American preemptive attack on Iran, aimed at destroying its nuclear installations. And I think we should talk about this more. We have a good idea of what this might mean for Iran, given the example we have from Iraq. Military bases, expropriation of the economy, the enforcement of a compliant political regime. In other words, a war on terror. Thank you.